You might have seen Leonard Pitt's column in Saturday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the Terry Schiavo case. If marriage has real moral force, let this be the last word. Now, Leonard Pitt's is arguing there in the Post-Dispatch that Michael Schiavo, Terry Schindler Schiavo's husband and guardian, ought to be able to, well, have her starved and dehydrated to death, and that he's acting in her best interest as her husband, and that he makes his case, Pitts makes his case, based upon the fact that, you know, marriage, everyone says, is something that should be held in high honor. We talk about the sanctity of marriage. He says, those of us who talk about sanctity of marriage ought to put our money where our mouth is. We ought to be in favor of letting Michael Schiavo have his wife dehydrated and starved to death. We're going to have Wesley Smith on in the first 25 minutes to respond not only to Leonard Pitts, but we'll hear a little bit from Senator John Kerry at a recent rally. This was just a couple days ago on stem cell research and Michael J. Fox. He is a victim of Parkinson's, famous actor, also appearing there with Kerry on the same subject. We'll get Wesley's reaction there at the very beginning of our conversation here on Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. A little later in the program, in about 25 minutes, Pastor Dick Fisher of Personal Freedom Outreach joins us to talk about the King James Only controversy, whether or not, you know, there are about, I think he outlines five or six different positions that are used to argue for King James Only, no other versions of the Bible except King James. You may be one of those people out there who've read one of those books. You say, wow, this sounds so reasonable. Maybe the King James is the only accurate, dependable, Spirit-inspired scripture. Well, we'll get Dick Fisher's response to that, but also he'll evaluate each one of those positions upon which King James Onlyism is based and answer the question of whether or not this position, if taken to an extreme, is cultish. Then, in the second hour of the program, Brad Miner, an interview we did with him yesterday on chivalry and the presidential candidates. You may have seen the vice presidential debate last night. We'll also be talking about that a little bit after our conversation with Brad Miner. In fact, the interchange between Senator Edwards and Vice President Cheney on gay marriage will be what we will focus on. I'd like your reaction to it there in the second hour. In the third hour, Dr. Cameron McKenzie joins us for the entire thing to talk about the Renaissance. Would there have been a Reformation without a Renaissance? We'll talk with him about what the Renaissance was and how important it was for the movement of the Reformation in the third hour of Issues, Etc. Wesley Smith is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and author of a forthcoming book titled Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. Wesley, welcome back. Wesley, welcome to Issues, Etc. All right, we'll connect with Wesley here in just a moment. One of the things that intrigues me about the Terry Schindler Schiavo case is that it is, I think Leonard Pitts is on to at least this, it is about marriage. It is about a husband and a wife. It is about Terry's husband and whether or not that marriage means anything and whether or not as a husband he should have what ought to be in other circumstances, his right to be her guardian and safeguard her life. What if the husband doesn't want to safeguard the wife's life? Can he still exercise his rights as the husband? Wesley Smith, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. It's really a joke to me when you even think of Michael Schiavo as her, quote, husband. This is a man who almost, from before the time, at least shortly after, I'll be more generous, after her injury began to date, he's been living with another woman since 1995. He has two children with her. He started a new family. I think in divorce law, that's called abandonment. So to even call Michael a husband as if there is still a sanctity of that relationship is utterly ludicrous. You have to just pretend that 90% of the facts in this case don't exist, and the only thing that matters is that technically they're not divorced under the law. But if Terry were capable of making any decisions, I bet they would be.
Okay. The columnist Leonard Pitts has written in our local paper here, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, over the weekend. The headline is, if marriage has real moral force, let this be the last word. The right to pull the plug should be in the hands of spouses, not lawmakers. Now, he's referring to what he considers to be governmental intrusion into the Terry Schindler Schiavo case in the person of Governor Jeb Bush. Now, this is what he has to say here, and I'd like your reaction. The person you love enough and trust enough to join in legal union is empowered to make decisions on your behalf if you are unable to make them for yourself. That's a sacred obligation, and it ought not to be violated even by parents, much less government, absent compelling evidence of a spouse's malfeasance or incompetence. We've seen no such evidence where Michael Schiavo is concerned.
We've seen nothing but evidence where Michael Schiavo is concerned. He told the medical malpractice jury in 1992 that he would take care of her for the rest of her life and his life. He had a medical expert come in and say she would live a normal lifespan, and he did that to increase the amount of damages that would be received out of the case. As soon as $1.2 million was in the bank, $750,000 in Terry's account, suddenly he remembered she wouldn't want to live like this and started refusing antibiotics and so forth. There are declarations by nurses who were in the nursing home where Terry lived in the mid-90s that he used to come in, refuse to permit any kind of rehabilitation, even though he told the jury in the medical malpractice case that he would have medical testing and rehabilitation. Since then, he's refused any rehabilitation. And one nurse said, under penalty of perjury in an affidavit, that he used to get furious, why hasn't this you-know-what died? Now, that has not been subject to cross-examination. He has not denied that. He has basically said, yes, I got mad because they weren't taking good enough care of Terry. But there is evidence upon evidence upon evidence. The conflict of interest financially, the abandonment of the sanctity of the marriage, living and having children with another woman, changing the stories with regard to what he told the medical malpractice jury and then later on. There was a guardian ad litem in 1998 when this thing began that said there are too many conflicts of interest. He should not be permitted to take her off food and water. And instead of that happening, the guardian ad litem got kicked off the case by the judge. So this fellow either is ignorant or is so besotten by the concept of the so-called right to die that that's all he can see.
Now, there are several things to deal with here. One of them occurs to me after I read Leonard Pitt's column, and that is, if Michael Schiavo were not Terry's husband, but in fact some other, let's say guardian ad litem, appointed at a previous time, and was behaving the way he does, not with regard to their marriage, that would not be possible, but with regard to her care, would he be considered objectively a fit guardian?
Of course not. In fact, the fact that he is a guardian is the great unexplored point in this whole case. He owes Terry, as guardian, he owes her what's called a fiduciary obligation. That means he has to put her welfare before his own. He owes her the utmost standards of loyalty. And yet, even though some doctors have said that she might benefit from therapy, that she might be able to learn how to eat without a feeding tube, he has refused, as guardian, to permit the very testing to find out whether or not this is so. That, to me, is malfeasance as a guardian.
There's another quote here, and I'd like your reaction to it, again from Leonard Pitt's column. There is a galling hypocrisy here. After all, in the alacrity with which some conservatives jettison the conservative credo, the government should interfere as little as possible in the lives and decisions of other people. Now, is it a fact that Governor Jeb Bush's efforts on the part of Terry Schiavo constitute government interference?
Well, I certainly don't think so, but here's a couple of points. First off, it isn't just conservatives who have fought to save Terry's life. One of the biggest actors or players, groups, in this whole fight has been the disability rights movement. There were, I think, 17 or 18 groups that came together to file an amicus brief. And disability rights groups almost across the board are liberal politically, very secular in their approach to things, and they're not pro-life on abortion. I'm speaking generally, but that's generally speaking the disability rights community. Secondly, the purpose of government is to protect the lives of all of its citizens. That is the ultimate purpose of government. No conservative or liberal that I'm aware of, well, let's strike that. I don't think that it is a conservative position that government shouldn't protect citizens. Moreover, that government shouldn't protect weak and vulnerable citizens who can't make decisions for themselves. Now, if Terry Schiavo had said, for example, let's say she were capable of making a decision and she had cancer, I don't want chemo, government wouldn't force her to take chemotherapy. But this is a situation where she is being pushed out of the lifeboat by a husband with tremendous conflicts of interest based on very vague statements she made in the 1980s, supposedly to her husband, his brother, and his brother's wife, about not wanting to be a burden and live dependent. But in those days, they weren't talking about taking food and water. They were talking about respirators. That was before the Nancy Cruzan case. I mean, this whole thing cries out for a brand new trial to take a look at all of the facts and circumstances of this case. And if doing that and protecting a vulnerable person like Terry isn't the job of the governor of the state of Florida, I don't know what is.
All right. Also on that note, you know, there is another branch of government. It's called the judicial system. And it seems here that the court on the other side of the issue has been in many ways not doing its duty to protect Terry Schindler Schiavo. Tell us about the court, in particular Judge Greer's decision.
Well, Judge Greer, this is a very odd situation. Judge Greer has allowed Michael Schiavo not to comply for years with mandatory provisions in the Florida statutory provision for disabled people who are wards, that the guardian is supposed to file each and every year a guardianship plan. A guardianship plan sets out prospectively, it's not looking back, here's what I did, although that's also done, but the guardianship plan says to the judge, here is the need, this is what the guardian's, the ward's problem is, or problems are. This is what I plan to do to take care of the guardian. This is my plan for the coming year. It is so important under Florida law that the guardianship power to act doesn't arise until the court signs off on this prospective guardianship plan. It is the very signing by the judge that gives the guardian his power to make decisions. For 3 years, and I don't know over the last couple of months, but for 3 years prior to that, Michael Schiavo would go into Judge Greer. He'd say, can I have an extension of time? Judge Greer would say, sure. And so for 3 years, there were no guardianship plans in place, which meant technically under the law, as I looked at it, now I'm not a Florida lawyer, but as I looked at that statute, Michael Schiavo may have been a guardian, but he had no power to act technically because there was no guardianship plan in place. And Judge Greer just allowed required Florida law to be thrown and tossed aside. Michael Schiavo was supposed to have a deposition taken. He hasn't showed up the last four times, even though there's a court order saying he has to have a deposition. I mean, it's almost as if there is the law for the state of Florida, but there's a special exception in the Schiavo case.
We're talking about a recent Leonard Pitts column on Terry Schindler Schiavo's case and other bioethical issues that we'll get to in just a moment with Wesley Smith. I'm Todd Wilkin. Okay, I want to read the opening part of this column to you, and I want you, if you would, in a very brief fashion, point by point, see if you can detect and correct any inaccuracies in the way the story is laid out. This is what Leonard Pitts writes. Is it too much to hope Terry Schiavo will finally be allowed to die in peace? Schiavo, 40, has been in what doctors describe as a persistent vegetative state since she fell ill and suffered brain damage 14 years ago. Her body lives, but the medical consensus is that her mind does not and never will. Doctors want to disconnect her feeding tube and allow her to die. Schiavo's husband agrees and gave permission for doctors to proceed.
Well, he's come first off that last point. It's not as if doctors went in and said, oh, let us do this, let us do that. And Michael said, oh, okay. He was the driving force behind this because he wanted to get on with his life. And I think, at least at the time he started this thing, there was still $700,000 in Terry's bank account that he would have inherited because she didn't have a will. Secondly, in terms of the persistent vegetative state diagnosis, the court made a ruling that she was in a persistent vegetative state. It is not a unanimous conclusion from doctors. There are doctors who say she isn't. And if you go to terrisfight.org, TerrisFight.org, you will see videos of her really seeming to interact with her environment. And under Florida law, if there can be any interaction, even if it's very sporadic, she's not in a persistent vegetative state. The problem here is that in order for, under Florida law, Michael Schiavo to be able to get the court order that he sought, you had to have clear and convincing evidence that this is what the ward would have wanted. And clear and convincing evidence is the highest civil justice standard there is. It's just a notch below beyond a beyond a reasonable doubt. And if judges don't follow that, then there's no point. There's no real protection in the law. And the evidence that Terry would not want to live was so questionable in this case that I'm stunned that any judge would say it's beyond a reason, as it's beyond clear and convincing evidence. And that's part of the problem here.
Okay, Wesley, let's move on to another issue, if we could. Presidential candidate, Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry and actor Michael J. Fox were on the campaign trail Monday this week in New Hampshire. Both of them talked about stem cell research. I'd like your reaction to both of them. First, let's hear from Senator Kerry.
We've got people lying awake at night wondering whether they're going to be around to see a daughter's graduation or a son's wedding or a grandson's first steps. The hard truth is that when it comes to stem cell research, this president is making the wrong choice to sacrifice science for extreme right-wing ideology, and that's unacceptable.
Your reaction, Wesley?
Well, if you believe that transforming nascent human life into a commodity to be harvested like a crop is not something that should be broadly funded by the federal government, I don't think it means you're an extreme right-wing ideologue. I think that the discussion over embryonic stem cell research, and by the way, he uses the term stem cell research as if that's only embryonic. Did you know that the Bush administration in 2003 put $225 million into stem cell research? You don't hear that from the media. $200 million of that was for adult stem cell research, and $25 million was for embryonic stem cell research. But the problem is that John Kerry is, and I'm not taking a partisan position here, but his position on this is demagogic. He is acting as if George Bush is taking away all hope for any medical advances by not funding stem cell research, and the contrary is true. Right now, there are human trials ongoing to use bone marrow stem cells to treat heart conditions because adult stem cells have been found to rebuild heart muscle. There are trials ongoing in Portugal where Dr. Carlos Lima has taken olfactory tissue, that's tissue from the nose that is filled with stem cells and is filled with nerve endings, and he has helped people like Christopher Reeve regain, by using their own tissues, regain muscle control, bladder control, which is huge, and also there was a woman who came to who testified in front of the Senate subcommittee a few months ago showing videos of her walking with braces. This is tremendous potential breakthrough. We are on the potential verge of exciting times with adult stem cell research where your own body tissues become potent medicine. Now, if you look at the published research so far, you see that juvenile diabetes has been cured, utterly cured, in mice using spleen cells. If you take a look at embryonic stem cell problems, they cause tumors, and there's a real potential problem of tissue rejection, which is why you have to get to human cloning, because the idea is to create human clones of patients and then take these embryos from the cloned embryos and destroy them to get stem cells and then inject them into yourself so they won't be rejected. Well, that is so many years away, even if it can be done, and the morality of creating human life for the purpose of destroying it and harvesting it is really questionable, and I don't think anybody who has problems with that kind of technology is a right-wing ideologue.
At the same event, actor Michael J. Fox, who suffers from Parkinson's and is now quite in evidence in his comportment in public, also spoke. Here's what he had to say.
Those of us in the Parkinson's community and the Alzheimer's community, we know what it's like to be frustrated and impatient. We're that way about stem cell research, and we're very excited John Kerry will get us back in track.
Your reaction there?
Well, I feel, obviously, a great deal of empathy for anybody, particularly somebody as young as Michael J. Fox, has had such a stellar success in terms of acting, having to experience difficult illness. But we don't change morality because famous people or other people get sick. But there's also a lot of misinformation here. First of all, stem cell research is not a likely prospect, either adult or embryonic, for Alzheimer's disease. There was a story in the Washington Post right after Ronald Reagan died, when the embryonic stem cell researchers pounced on his death and used it, I thought, in a very ghoulish fashion to try to push for stem cell therapy, increase in embryonic stem cell research to help Ronald Reagan situation. Well, the Washington Post pointed out, in a very rare display of mainstream media proper journalism on these issues, that it's a fairy tale to believe. And that was the term used by a stem cell researcher. It's a fairy tale to believe that stem cells are going to help Alzheimer's, because it's a whole brain disease. And he admitted that the research community allows, I think quite cruelly, people with Alzheimer's and their families to believe that somehow embryonic stem cells are going to be a cure for Alzheimer's, when they almost certainly will not be. It is potentially a cure for Parkinson's disease. But again, if you take a look at the problem with embryonic stem cells, they tried to treat Parkinson's in mice with embryonic stem cells, and 20% of the mice died of brain tumors. You cannot use embryonic stem cells safely in humans at this point. On the other hand, as I believe I've discussed on this show, there's a fellow out in California named Dennis Turner who appears to have been put in a substantial remission from his Parkinson's using his own brain stem cells. And there's some other patients who used a hormone, a growth hormone type factor. It's called glial hormone or glial factor, who had tremendous alleviation of their symptoms. Plus, there are other treatments that are not tissue-based. So to say that we need embryonic stem cells to cure Parkinson's is highly misleading. And if there would be cures with embryonic stem cells, they're very far down the line.
With only 1 minute, the Nazis experimented on Jews and others in concentration camps during World War II in order to further scientific progress. That was part of their ghoulish intent, but they thought they could, you know, make scientific breakthroughs there. Is this an equal comparison? The end justifies the means.
Well, yes and no. No meaning, you know, people who want to do this kind of research should not be equated with Joseph Mengele, and I know you don't mean that. But what we do find here is that this fight is more than just about the science. It is about who gets to decide morals and ethics. And this is not a science fight as much as it is a moral and ethics fight. And there's a new philosophy called philosophical scientism, it's actually not new, that says the salvation of humankind isn't faith, it is science. And therefore, science should be allowed virtually unfettered access to do what it wants. Moreover, it proclaims, the only people who can say what is or is not moral in science are scientists. And therefore, those of us who are not scientists and not part of that establishment are supposed to shut up. Well, guess what? It's not going to happen on my watch, because this is a democratic society and we need checks and balances. The Mengele experiments with twins, as a matter of pure science, were very interesting.
Only about 10 seconds here, Wesley.
Yeah, were very interesting, but morally, they were an abomination. You have to have moral checks and balances, like for over science, as with any other human activity.
Wesley Smith is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute and attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and he's authoring a forthcoming book titled Consumer's Guide to the Brave New World. I look forward to your new book, Wesley, and look forward to talking to you again. Thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
You can read Wesley's columns at his website, WesleyJSmith.com, WesleyJSmith.com. When we come back from this break, Pastor Dick Fisher of Personal Freedom Outreach will be our guest. We're going to talk about the King James Only movement and the controversy surrounding it. Stay with us.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Reformation has been variously misunderstood. Some people think it was about radical individualism, every man for himself Christianity. Others believe that the Reformation was really a rebellion against the authority of the church. Still others believe that the Lutheran Reformation was a good start, but didn't go far enough. If you'd like to rightly understand the Reformation, you need Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, The Renaissance and Reformation Movements. This two-volume set is $40.99 together or $23.99 individually. Visit Our Issues Etc. website and browse before you buy. Issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section or call Concordia Publishing House to order these books. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, the Renaissance and Reformation Movements.
People living on parched land in the African country of Zimbabwe needed Bible teaching, farming help, and medical care. A pastor in the area was constantly praying for help. Now this Global Minute shares the good news that God sent a nurse to the village. Vicky Graham and a group of other short-term missionaries with Operation Mobilization met the pastor in one part of Zimbabwe among the Tonga people. He cried out that his people needed help to understand God. Vicky also saw the great health needs. Today, Vicky treats their medical needs, and through her, resources have also reached the pastors. She prays against the witchcraft the Tonga family use in battling sickness. Vicky is an example of creative outreach among Operation Mobilization missionaries. Pray for Christ to strengthen her. Get more information by visiting the website www.usa.om.org. That's usa.om.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. My friend Bill shared an email about a woman who visited the shop of a silversmith. The silversmith held a piece of silver over the fire, explaining that the silver had to be held in the very middle of the fire to burn away any impurities. The woman, a Bible student, thought of Malachi 3 verse 3, God will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. She asked the silversmith if he had to be there the whole time. He answered yes. He had to hold and keep his eye on that silver. Otherwise, it might be in the fire too long and be destroyed. How do you know when the silver is fully refined? She asked. Oh, that's easy, he said, when I see my image in it. That anonymous email helps us understand tough days. The Lord watches over you, Psalm 121, verse 5. And the refining of Christians will achieve its goal. Philippians 1, verse 6 says, He who began a good work in you will bring it to completion until the day of our Lord Jesus Christ. On that day, fully refined, you will see Him face to face, 1 Corinthians 13, verse 12. How else can we understand the strange statement of St. James, chapter 1, verse 2, consider it pure joy whenever you face trials of many kinds?
What difference does it make? My vote doesn't count.
What difference does it make? My vote doesn't count.
What difference does it make? My vote doesn't count.
What difference does it make? My vote doesn't count.
You're not the only one who thinks their vote doesn't count, which is exactly why it does. Commit to this year's presidential election by fasting and praying the Sunday before. Then get out and vote on November 2nd. A message from the National Day of Prayer Task Force.
Tomorrow is a special day on Issues Etc. We're going to be out and about in mid-Missouri. Actually, we're going to be broadcasting during our regular time from 3 to 6 tomorrow afternoon, live from Trinity Lutheran Church in Columbia, Missouri. That means our mid-Missouri listeners ought to take note, because each and every one of you within driving distance of Columbia, Missouri, we are invited to the live broadcast and to a dinner afterwards, $10 a head for the dinner, and a little bit of a Q&A with our guests for tomorrow's live broadcast at Trinity Lutheran Church in Columbia, Missouri. You're all invited to come. Now, our guest tomorrow will include Dr. Ken Sherb. He's pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. We're going to be talking with him about the Book of Proverbs. He's authored a Bible study in the Lifelight series on Proverbs. Pastor Eric Rotman will join us to talk about the Means of Grace. He's co-author of To All Eternity, The Essential Teachings of Christianity. Marriage will be the subject in the third hour with Dr. Peter Kurowski. He's authored that book. It's the only book on marriage that we sell here on Issues Etc. called Lifelines of Love. The broadcast is from 3 to 6 at Trinity Lutheran Church at Columbia, Missouri. I'll be there. My guest will be there live. Afterwards, there's a dinner, $10 a head. I'll give you a number that you can call in order to reserve a place at the dinner, 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438, or go to our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section for more information on the live broadcast tomorrow at Trinity Lutheran Church in Columbia, Missouri. I'm looking forward to seeing you there. Pastor Dick Fisher is our guest. We're going to talk about the King James Only controversy. It's not only a controversy. Some might say that in some of its manifestations, King James Onlyism is cultish. We'll find out what Pastor Fisher thinks here in this 25 Minutes of Issues, etc. He's pastor of Laurelton Park Baptist Church in Bricktown, New Jersey, director, researcher, and writer for Personal Freedom Outreach, and author of an article in the latest issue of PFO's The Quarterly Journal titled "The Cultic Root System of David Otis Fuller and King James Onlyism." Pastor Fisher, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on.
If someone just prefers the King James as a version, that is, they like the poetic language, they like the somewhat old-fashioned sounding language, or they prefer it for, say, the context of Sunday morning worship, is there a problem there?
No, I don't think there is, and I say that in my article. I think we have to ask ourselves, what does a belief produce? And if a belief system produces division and rancor and all kinds of evil things, we would say there's got to be something wrong with that belief. But this position, which in my article I call the readable reverence position, it's held by Dr. Henry Morris, it's held by Pensacola Christian College, and the grandeur of the language is cited in the reverence for Elizabethan English. I think within that position, if they feel that the these and the thous are more respectful of God and they simply prefer it, usually they're more tolerant. I say they confuse inspiration with aesthetics, but I certainly see in that position a live and let live position, and we have people in our church like that. But that's really not what I'm dealing with, because what few people know is that within the King James Only position, there are about six different positions, and I want to see them in this camp explain to me what they really believe, because there's all kind of confusion and division within the camp as to what the foundations of this belief really are. Actually, I don't do this out of theory, because a few years ago we had a group of people who went on a King James Version only tirade and made demands on me to let no one in the pulpit without the King James Version. They insisted our foreign missionaries, can you imagine, our foreign missionaries in foreign countries with foreign languages use only the King James Version. We had to chuck our hymnals because they had verses in there not from the King James, along with the King James. And then they told the congregation, because I wouldn't consent, that I was tied into the Antichrist. I mean, it was brutal, very, very brutal, and very mean and ugly. And it really did divide our church some years ago. And so we put in our statement of faith that we allow people to the liberty to use versions of the Bible. We warn against cultic translations, and we ask for using wisdom even in paraphrases. But modern translations we certainly allow our people to use, and 77% of American ministers use other versions other than the King James, and we can't say they're all deceived, because 77% is a big percentage.
Now, you talk about this tiny minority who not only prefer the King James, but they fairly well require it as an article of faith. Before we get into the cultic roots of King James Onlyism, let's go through those six positions that are held within the King James Only camp. Some of them are overlapping, some of them are, not all of them are mutually exclusive. Let's deal with what you call the re-inspiration position.
Well, the re-inspiration position is held by Peter Ruckman in Florida, and he believes and teaches that the 1611 edition is even superior to the Greek and Hebrew texts, that they actually correct the Greek and Hebrew. We did a separate article on Peter Ruckman some years ago for Personal Freedom Outreach, but we mentioned him. And the obvious question you have to ask a guy like Peter Ruckman is, which King James Version? Because it's been through major revisions since 1611, and a lot of people don't know or realize that the 1611 King James Version contained the Apocrypha, and I have a facsimile of the 1611, not only the Apocrypha, but the listing of all the church feasts and the Feast of the Virgin Mary. And we know historically, it's just a hard fact, that there were many revisions. The revision that we use today is the 1762 revision of Paris and Blaney, which eliminated the Apocrypha. And, you know, what we would have to say is that if 1611 brought the pure, perfect Word of God that corrected the Greek and Hebrew before it that up till 1611 everybody had faulty Bibles and nobody really had the Word of God. So this is a serious thing to somehow confuse inspiration and translation. And on top of it, the cultic manifestations of Ruckman with foul language and very inappropriate language when referring to opposition is just appalling. It's appalling for people to see a person who claims to be a Christian to be acting in this way. So that's the re-inspiration position is primarily Peter Ruckman, and most want to stay away from him, although I have met Ruckmanites.
Now, so the basic position there is that even the original autographs, even the manuscripts of the Old and the New Testament in Hebrew and Greek, respectively, are not as trustworthy as the 1611 translation.
That's absolutely correct.
That's the position held by the re-inspirationists.
Yeah, yeah.
The next position that you deal with is called the received text position. Tell us about it.
Well, this position, the received text position, argues that the Greek versions of the Bible that went before the King James was translated into English, the Greek versions that went before and led up to a translation made by Erasmus, who was a Roman Catholic priest. He made a translation into Greek from many of the existing translations of his time, the Greek revisions of his time. And ultimately, this text, this Greek text that was compiled by Erasmus, eventually was dubbed the Textus Receptus, although it was 13 years after the King James Version was translated.
Now, that's very important that you point this out, because those who are arguing that the King James only should be used because it was based upon Erasmus's Greek New Testament, I should point out the New Testament, not the Old Testament,
right.
Have a real problem with history in that this thing is not compiled and put together until after the King James is translated.
The Textus Receptus is many revisions after Erasmus's Greek version. And you know, they call all Bibles somehow Catholic Bibles because of sometime an association with the Vulgate. But we know that Erasmus used the Vulgate as part of his source.
Now, we should say at this point, Pastor Fisher, that there are people who have made a study of the critical texts of the New Testament and see a lot of merit in and have a preference for the Textus Receptus, that version of the Erasmus's version. Luther's vernacular translation into German was based upon that text because that was the best text he had.
Yes.
So we're not saying anything against the Textus Receptus per se when we evaluate this position.
No, and in fact, one of the positions I deal with, the fifth position I deal with, is what I call the reasoned eclectic position. Harry Sturz, what he says is, well, you understand there was another family of texts called the Byzantine family of text that was the underpinnings for the Textus Receptus. And Sturz says the Byzantine line has value as an independent text type and ought to be put into consideration with other text types as well. So no, we wouldn't say the received text, the Textus Receptus, has no merit whatsoever. It has value. But in all of this study, I think all manuscripts have to be considered.
The other position, another position, is called the rigid tradition, or you call it the rigid tradition position.
Yeah, this is very interesting. The Byzantine text type, they believe, we don't have any Byzantine text types, purely Byzantine text types, before 350 AD. So they believe a man by the name of Lucian created the Byzantine text type originally, because none of the church fathers used it, and we don't find it before 350 AD. But the Byzantine text type, which was sort of the underpinnings eventually that led to the Textus Receptus, and the underpinnings, Erasmus used Byzantine text types for his original Greek revision. And this text type was looked upon by a man named Dean Bergen as being the best text type. And he said the test of Catholic antiquity determines all this. So basically, it's confusing translation with tradition. And I think to say that the Byzantine text type actually reflects the originals, the original autographs, is a faith position, because there's no proof that it existed before 350 in that form. So I think Bergen, again, did call for a revision of the King James Version. He didn't say that the King James Version was perfect, but he thought it was far better because it was based ultimately on Byzantine text types.
The fourth position that you will find among King James onlyists is what you call the readable and reverence position. You talked briefly about
it before. Right. And I believe that people who prefer, if they have a preference for the King James, that's fine. I actually preach from the New King James because as a young Christian, I learned the King James and all my memory work is in the King James. And so some years ago, I decided that I was explaining old words so often. I mean, the words in the King James like ouches and eared and niecings and anon and bestead and eschew. I spent all my time in the pulpit trying to explain these old English words, where the New King James already has them translated into modern English. So I use the New King James in the pulpit, and I use the New King James in the pews for unity of reading, and that's fine. We prefer to do it that way, and when it's a preference and it doesn't create division and a lot of difficulties and unrest, that can be fine. So I don't know, but it seems like even those that have the so-called readable and reverence position, there is a bit of pride in a way that they've really got the real deal.
You mentioned before the reasoned eclecticism position, and how really this is not so much a confusion on the issue of inspiration as much as trying to take a position without any real hard evidence for the King James Version being superior. Is that
right.
A good summary there of the critique?
Yeah, and I think Harry Sturr says that the Byzantine manuscripts, which are forerunners of the King James, which are some kind of called majority text type, they're independent of other types, but they should be considered. They can stand on their own. They're a good witness. We refer to them and so on. He doesn't say they're superior or inferior, but they're authoritative enough to be taken seriously. That's basically what he says.
The final one that you deal with, and then we're going to talk here in just a minute about the cultic roots of some King James onlyism, is what you call the rummage and pick position.
Yeah, I find that a lot of King James people really don't know what they believe or what their ideas are based on, so they mix and match things. They'll talk about the Textus Receptus, but they don't understand the Textus Receptus didn't come into being until the mid-1600s. They don't understand the difference between the Byzantine text and the received text or the Textus Receptus. They don't understand any of these nuances whatsoever, so they'll float all around in and out of position. Sometimes they'll take a Ruckman position, basically, and sometimes they'll take a Textus Receptus position, and sometimes they'll take a Dean Bergen Byzantine position. Sometimes they'll slide in and out of, we just prefer it. But then it's just a mix and match thing. And Jack Chick seems to be a model of this. Sometimes he sounds like a Ruckmanite. Sometimes he sounds like he's into Textus Receptus. Sometimes he sounds like he's into Byzantine. I don't think he really knows, you know. And it just creates all kind of confusion. And it does create a lot of argumentation. As I said, they confuse inspiration and argumentation.
You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the King James Only controversy with Pastor Dick Fisher. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk about the cultic roots of some King James-only believers. And you begin this conversation by talking about the real father of the modern King James-only position. Who is he?
Well, the King James-only position, whether people know it or not, only began in 1930. All this chaos erupted in 1930 when a Seventh-day Adventist by the name of Benjamin Wilkinson wrote a book called Our Authorized Bible Vindicated. And he basically chose the King James as the only pure, unadulterated Word of God because he felt like the King James best backed his Adventist heresies. He is the father of modern King James onlyism. This is unheard of before 1930. We didn't have all this chaos and confusion, and we wouldn't even be discussing it before 1930. And what happened was that David Otis Fuller, in the 1970s, put out a book called Which Bible? And deceptively, he hid the Adventist background of Wilkinson. But half of Fuller's book, which is quite large, is all of the chapters out of Wilkinson's book. And so he brought it in by stealth. And where Wilkinson was quoting Ellen G. White, Fuller didn't acknowledge that he dropped the footnotes and never acknowledged that Wilkinson kept quoting Ellen White. And so he hid Wilkinson's background and that he was a cult member and a cult teacher. And he brought in this position into evangelicalism and especially into Baptist circles. I mean, this position, I want to tell you today, is devastating the Baptist churches. Doug Kudelik, who does this study on this topic all the time, he says it's been destructive and distractive among Baptists more than any other controversy since the Campbellite heresy of the 19th century. So it really, I just had a missions conference, and we had a number of home missionaries in, and they said this position is devastating churches, this King James only position, and they don't realize it's a cultic position. That's why it's producing cultic results and divisions of all kinds, because it basically is cultic root and it has cultic fruit.
Refresh our memory on Seventh-day Adventism, since the father of King James-onlyism was a Seventh-day Adventist and wrote in that context, not only in that context, but as you said, chose the King James-only position because it backed up the teachings of Seventh-day Adventism. What are some of those teachings that are considered aberrant or heretical?
Well, a Baptist minister in 1844 predicted the second coming of Christ, which a guy named Miller, which never occurred. And to salvage Miller, a lady by the name of Ellen White said that what happened in 1844 was Jesus went into a separate compartment in heaven to begin what he called the investigative judgment. And Christ was going to then sort out who was saved and who was not saved and sort of finish the work of atonement in this investigative judgment room. And Jesus said it is finished. He doesn't have to go into a room to finish atonement and his atoning work and pick out who's lost and who's saved. He knows those that are his. And then the Adventists were into saying Sunday was the mark of the beast. You had to worship on Saturday. And then they were imposing legislation of food on people and Old Testament rules on people. Seventh-day Adventism basically grew out of Ellen White's teachings. And Wilkinson was a committed follower of Ellen White, as his writings show.
Are there other errors made within the King James-only position with regard to the King James Bible itself? One very simple one. I was once, this was a long time ago, probably 10, 12 years ago, I was speaking, and someone approached me afterwards with their Bible in their hand. They took umbrage at the fact that I had been reading from a different version. I think at the time it was probably the NIV or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They opened up their Bible to the title page, King James. They pointed to the word authorized version. They said, look, this is the only authorized version of the Bible. When it says authorized, that means authorized by God. And that, for as far as they were concerned, that settled it.
Well, that's not really true, authorized by God. King James may have tacked that authorized title on it because it was authorized in England to be read by the highest authority at that time, who was the king. But the fact is, in history, the Puritans, when they settled this country, brought the Geneva Bible. They did not bring the King James Bible. Our country was founded on the Geneva Bible. And that's another thing. Like, Wilkinson makes so many mistakes. He tries to say that the so-called authorized version, which King James Version, was the version that laid the foundation of our country. It's just not true. It's absolutely not true. They despised the authorized version. They wanted the Geneva version because the Geneva version had a lot of reform notes, which fit them very, very well. So that was the version that we used for 50 years in the founding of after the founding of our country, and it was the first version to include verses and so on. So, a king can call a Bible anything he wants, but that doesn't mean God does.
Our call in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jeff is calling from his car. Jeff, welcome.
Hi, Pastor Todd. I was just going to say that the United Pentecostal Church International, based out of Hazelwood, Missouri, is one of those that even have in their bylaws and their constitution that they The King James Version of the Bible, the 1611, is the authorized version and is the only version that is accepted in our church.
Thank you very much for that tidbit there, Jeff. Pastor Fisher.
Yes, well, as I said, the authorized version, of course, was authorized by a king, and it was certainly a human designation, so I don't know that the Apostle Paul knew anything about the King James Version. Unfortunately, if we had to wait to 1611, that means for many centuries no one had the Word of God.
Real quickly, with about a minute here before we have to go, give us some names. You've given us many already, but other than the ones you've given us, give us some names of King James-only advocates today.
Well, the most well-known is Peter Ruckman, with the the King James being re-inspired. David Otis Fuller, Edward Hills is another one. Donald Waite is another one. Hills, Fuller, Waite, they seem to be more in the Textus Receptus position. Dean Bergen, of course, was an Anglican. You know, Bergen is upheld, as an Anglican, and they down Westcott and Hort, who did an earlier translation using other manuscripts, and yet they were Anglicans. So they picked the Anglicans they want. The King James translators were Anglicans, so they certainly weren't Baptist. Zane Hodges holds to the Byzantine text type. He's out of Dallas Seminary. So there are these names, and again, there is not agreement in this field. It is a divided field and a confused field.
With only 30 seconds, just a bullet point list of the cultic fruit. We talked about the roots, but the cultic fruit of King James-onlyism?
Well, the cultic fruit is elitism and pride. You know, we know something better. We have an inn. We have the best Bible. We have God's Word, and you don't. That's number one. Then division, and then name-calling. I mean, I was classified as the Antichrist. I got promoted. I thought it maybe would be a little more well-known than I would. But anyway, that kind of thing where division occurs and strife occurs, and that's of the flesh, according to James 3:17.
Pastor Dick Fisher, thank you for being our guest.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Pastor Dick Fisher, pastor of Laurelton Park Baptist Church in Bricktown, New Jersey, director, researcher, and writer for Personal Freedom Outreach, and author of an article in the latest issue of PFO's The Quarterly Journal, The Cultic Root System of David Otis Fuller and King James Onlyism. You can get the latest issue of The Quarterly Journal by calling Personal Freedom Outreach. Their headquarters are here in St. Louis. Area code 314-921-9800. 314-921-9800. Ask to receive the Quarterly Journal, 314-921-9800, or visit their website, pfo.org. pfo.org. It's the website for Personal Freedom Outreach. When we come back from this break, hour two of Issues, Etc., we'll kick it off with a conversation with Brad Miner. He's author of the new book, The Complete Gentleman, A Modern Man's Guide to Chivalry. We'll talk about chivalry, gentlemanliness, and the presidential candidates.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.